The fifth therapeutic lifestyle change that you discuss is recreation and enjoyable activities. Involvement in enjoyable activities is central to healthy lifestyles, and the word recreation, summarizes some of the many benefits. Recreation can involve play and playfulness, which appear to reduce defensiveness, enhance well-being, and foster social skills and maturation in children. Recreation can also involve humor, which appears to mitigate stress, enhance mood, support immune function and healing, and serve as a mature defense mechanism. Turns out to be pretty important and not just, stuff that jokes are made of.
Really? we should have a better time.
Exactly. Of course, comics are it's always said that they have sort of, emotional disaster areas and have all sorts of childhood problems and all of that stuff. But at least they have humor working for them, which can hopefully offset some of the negatives in their life. Further recreational activities include art and other aesthetic pleasures, which have long been employed for self-healing. Many studies suggest that enjoyable recreational activities and the positive emotions that ensue foster multiple psychological and physical benefits. So the simple capacity to engage in enjoyable activities. So as you said, we have many, many lifestyle changes that we can choose, but it's important, choose one that you like.
Yeah, it really is important. And one of the professional deformations that occurs in the mental health field is there's such an emphasis on pathology and getting rid of pathology, but there's an underestimation of the importance of paying attention to client strengths and what brings them happiness and joy, and just focusing on and reinforcing those.
Right, and working with well-being and not
exactly.
Just with diseases. Yeah. Item number six: relaxation and stress management. And this is fairly obvious, but it's extremely widespread. Chronic stressors can exact a major toll across multiple organ systems and levels. This toll extends from psychological to physiological to chemical to genomic expression. Even though stress is universal, few people are trained in managing it. And strangely, that's true of the psychiatric community as well. Not very skilled in all the ways of stress management that are out there.
Yeah, it's really an underutilized area, to be sure.
Right.
And there are just a lot of things that we know work now.
Right.
And you'll probably touch on some of them.
Well, exactly. We have right here many skillful strategies for stress management are now available. Specific stress management skills include somatic, psychological, and contemplative approaches. Somatic skills span both ancient Oriental and contemporary Western techniques. The Chinese mindful movement practices of Tai Chi and Qigong are increasingly popular in the West, and research studies suggest they are associated with both physical and psychological benefits. Western self-management skills include mental approaches such as self-hypnosis and guided imagery, as well as somatic approaches, especially muscle relaxation therapies that center on systematically tightening and relaxing major muscle groups. By doing this, patients learn to identify and release muscle tension and eventually to self-regulate both muscle and psychological tensions. Muscle relaxation skills are widely used for the treatment of anxiety disorders, including panic and generalized anxiety disorders, and meta-analyses reveal medium to large effect sizes. So it is sort of generally the case that if you specifically look for a psychologist, you can find ones that are trained in stress management. And they, use a wide variety of techniques that are helpful and useful. The problem is just that stress reduction techniques itself, across all forms of mental health training, isn't as widespread as it could be.
Yeah, well said. And yes, you can find someone who is trained in some of these, but it's pretty unusual to find someone who has a spectrum of approaches ranging from say muscle relaxation to some of the movement meditations to say yoga, etc. So it's an issue. Fine, but there are, on the other hand, there are a few and a growing number of people who are clinicians who specialize in this. So it's beginning to change.
Right. Contemplative skills such as meditation and yoga are now practiced by millions of people in the United States and by hundreds of millions worldwide. Concomitantly, an explosion of meditation research has demonstrated a wider array of effects, psychological, therapeutic, neural, physiological, biochemical, and chromosomal than are associated with any other psychotherapy, which is astonishing. Partially responsive psychodynamic disorders include, for example, cardiovascular hypertension and hypercholesterolemia, hormonal disorders such as primary dysmenorrhea and type 2 diabetes, asthma, and chronic pain. Responsive psychological difficulties include, among others, insomnia, anxiety, depressive eating, and borderline personality disorders. More effects than any other form of psychotherapy is saying quite a lot, but the evidence is there, isn't it?
It is, and I don't doubt that other therapies have a similar, if not quite as extensive, range of effects, but it's amazing. You know, when you and I first started talking about meditation, it was like, well, there's a study here, there's a study there.
Right.
When Charles Tart published his classic book, States of Consciousness, way back in the 70s, he said he published two-thirds of the meditation literature because he published two articles.
Right.
So the fact that in just a few decades, this has gone from something was regarded as weird and kind of some people, little brown people in the Orient did.
Right.
To what is now the second most researched psychotherapeutic technique is quite extraordinary.
It is. And we, of course, are both longtime practitioners and can speak to the many benefits of the practice. And most of them, of course, center on a kind of medical, physiological set of parameters. Things like blood pressure and pulse and brainwave patterns and so on. And very few of them deal with what meditation is actually designed to do, which is discover God. So that part of meditation tends to get left out. It's sort of spiritual dimensions, still largely because Western modernity doesn't know how to handle spiritual and religious issues, which we'll get to in just a moment.
God is very hard to measure,
and it's very difficult to come up with studies on that. But that is the primary. I mean, meditation is the royal road to the superconscious, and as such, its primary use. But along the way, it has enormous number of other benefits, and as this research is showing. In addition to its benefits for relaxation and stress management, meditation may also enhance measures of psychological capacities, health, and maturity in both patients and non-patients. Particularly important to healthcare professionals are findings that meditation can enhance valued caregiver qualities such as empathy, sensitivity, emotional stability, and psychological maturity while reducing distress and burnout. On the cognitive side, studies suggest that meditation can enhance some measures of cognition and may reduce age-related cognitive losses and corresponding brain shrinkage. It's quite a list.
That's quite a list. Isn't it amazing?
It is. It's astonishing. And it's astonishing that what is actually a fairly, generally speaking, a fairly simple psychological activity of attention deployment in a certain way, different than habitually used, that something like that could reach through as many systems as it does and have as many profound effects as almost anything that is out there. It's really astonishing.
It really is. And again, that this has come in just the last few decades. And we'll keep in mind, as you said, you know, the primary goal of these practices is spiritual, and that occurs in long-term practitioners. And 95-99% of the studies that have been done on short, very short-term practice. So
right.
We're only just beginning to appreciate the long-term potentials. And when I last looked at the literature, I counted and looked at the research on advanced practitioners. I counted 12 capacities that advanced meditation practitioners now displayed that psychologists had formerly thought were impossible.
Yeah.
Ranging from, example, lucid dreaming, the ability to stay lucid during dreams, to the capacity to regulate the autonomic nervous system, to extreme perceptual sensitivity, and on and on and on.
Right.
So, we're just beginning to map out the more advanced possibilities.
Right, exactly. And that was one of the problems of early meditation research, is they would take people often that were just starting and measure something at the beginning of the month and at the end of the month, and they couldn't find any changes, so it was like it was doing nothing. And then slowly started extending the amount of time and the meditators been practicing and the amount of time that they covered in their formal studies, and all of a sudden these things started to emerge. And the longer the time they studied, the more things were emerging. And as you say, we're still at the beginning of that discovery process, and it is turning out to be, you know, exceptional.
Indeed, indeed.
And is connected directly with the seventh lifestyle change, which is religious and spiritual involvement. And this is one of the most misunderstood lifestyle areas that there is. And I think you handled it really extremely well. And I want to read several paragraphs from this section because I think it's so important. And the points that you make are so important. Religious and spiritual concerns are vitally important to most people and most patients. Some 90% of the world's population engages in religious or spiritual practices. These practices are a major means of coping with stress and illness, and most patients say they would welcome their health professionals inquiring about religious issues, yet few health professionals do so. It's just a taboo topic, isn't it?
It certainly has been. Times are changing. They're definitely changing.
Yeah.
It has been very much a taboo topic.
And one of the reasons, of course, is that at the very least, there are two types of what we would think of as religious or spiritual involvement. And the easiest way to put it is one of them is pre-rational and one of them is trans-rational. And frankly, the pre-rational religions are often a source of a lot of regressive activity and hostility and ethnocentric focusing. And the trans-rational practices are a source of profound liberation and global compassionate awareness and activity and virtually all the good things that you can name. And so under the same term, religion or spiritual, and under the same tent, two very different practices are included. And since, you know, some of the bad stuff does indeed apply to some of these practices, it's been hard for individuals to tell what the good stuff was. But that's slowly changing, and you do deal with that issue here in this article.
Yeah, and let me just draw out, Ken, because there's something you said once in a conversation we had which was very illuminating for me, and I've shared it with a number of people, but I have not seen it in your writing, and you pointed out that these pre-rational and trans-rational religions, the pre-rational focuses on a narrative, and if you believe the narrative, you're saved. But the trans-rational religions are basically psychotechnologies. They're ways of training the mind to cultivate desired qualities and capacities and states and stages. And
exactly.
That's a beautifully succinct differentiation, and I would just hope that that idea gets out more widely.
Yeah, and it really is surprising, and it's surprising how well that generalization holds up. But you really do find those two differences, and you know, one is believing a story, and the other is changing your mind, fundamentally transforming your mind. And these are two very, very different activities. but both of them, for various complex reasons, have existed under the net, under the tent of religious and spiritual practices. Considerable research suggests a complex but usually beneficial relationship between religious involvement and mental health. Benefits span an array of health measures. Mental health benefits include enhanced psychological, relational, and marital well-being, as well as reduced rates of disorders such as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and suicide. For physical health, religious involvement seems beneficially related to both specific disorders, such as hypertension, and to non-specific mortality rates. Strikingly, those who attend religious services at least weekly tend to live approximately 7 years longer than those who do not, even when factors such as baseline health and health behaviors are systematically controlled. Contemplative practices such as meditation offer further psychological, somatic, and spiritual benefits. That's really significant.
Isn't that amazing that just attending a religious community once a week, that correlates with a 7-year lifespan difference? I mean, that's as much as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so, many factors going into that. Yeah. And some of them, of course, has to do with direct practices like meditation. And some has to do with behaviors that are fostered by many religious organizations, including, cutting down on sinful activities like drinking and smoking.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that just as a generalization, add 7 years to your life if once a week you're popping into the local church or synagogue. And then here we get to the next area that I think you covered so well and is so important. And it's the section you call Religion, Spirituality, and Psychological Development. So bear with me while I read a few paragraphs here. It is important for mental health professionals to recognize that there are multiple levels of religious development. These levels range from pre-conventional to conventional to post-conventional, or from pre-personal to personal to transpersonal, and are associated with extremely different kinds of religious faith, practice, behavior, and institutions. For example, consider the developmental stages of religious faith. At the pre-conventional level, mythic literal faith involves an unreflective literal acceptance of culturally provided beliefs. At the synthetic conventional level, people begin to create their own individual, but still largely unreflective, synthesis of diverse conventional beliefs. At later post-conventional stages, exemplified by conjunctive and universalizing faith, individuals critically reflect on conventional assumptions, open themselves to multiple perspectives, confront paradoxes, and extend their care and concern to all peoples. When developmental differences go unrecognized, problems ensue. For example, the views of one level are taken as normative, and those at this level tend to assume that people at other levels are mistaken, misguided, malevolent, or disturbed. Many contemporary religious and cultural conflicts appear to reflect these kinds of cross-level misunderstandings. The developmental component to religious or spiritual understanding or intelligence is extraordinarily important, isn't it? And yet it's overlooked everywhere.
It really is, and I hope I cited you as a reference there, because most of those ideas originally yours.
But, yes, you did. It's just shocking, really.
It is, and I think that, we've talked about this, but I think both of us agree that a recognition of the developmental dimension of religious life is probably one of the most important ideas to get out into the culture, because
right.
So much of the conflict within cultures and between cultures at this stage are basically cross-level conflicts.
Exactly. And you go on to point out several of them. You say, this developmental perspective brings new clarity to many religious and spiritual issues. For example, it makes clear that religions are not only culturally diverse, but also developmentally diverse. and that mental health professionals need to be sensitive to both kinds of diversity. Religion can be an expression of immaturity, conventional maturity, and post-conventional maturity, and of corresponding motives and concerns ranging from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric. Interpretations that view religion as, for example, always regressive or always transcendental invariably overlook this developmental perspective. Examples of reductionistic interpretations that view religions as necessarily regressive or pathological include the writings of the so-called neo-atheists, such as the recent extremely popular books, The God Delusion, The End of Faith, and God is Not Great, all of which are ignorant of developmental research. Unfortunately, the widespread failure to recognize developmental differences in faith, morality, values, ego, worldview, and more, and their far-reaching implications for religion and multiple other areas of life, seems a significant factor underlying many contemporary cultural conflicts. Indeed, from the culture wars to notions of what's spiritual and what's regressive, a lack of developmental understanding just seems to be epidemic.
Yeah, it really does, and you know, this is it's hard to overestimate the importance of this ignorance.
Yeah, there's hardly a topic discussed in popular culture that couldn't benefit from the clarity that a developmental perspective would bring. You say, of course, religious behavior can sometimes be regressive or pathological. However, religious behavior can also both express and foster healthy, mature, and even exceptionally mature development. Contemporary research and meta-analysis are supportive because meditators tend to score higher on measures of ego, moral, and cognitive development, as well as self-actualization, coping skills, and defenses, and studies and stages of consciousness. Ideally, religious and spiritual traditions offer both legitimacy, support for people's current level of psychological and faith development, as well as authenticity, support for maturation beyond current levels. Given the significance of religious and spiritual involvement, it seems important for therapists to be familiar with developmental and other key issues and, where appropriate, to inquire about and support healthy involvement in this domain. And as the research shows, most clients not only don't mind their doctors asking about their spiritual or religious orientations, they would actually appreciate it.
Yeah, they would. And there is some growing awareness of this, fortunately. Of course, once again, if we look at the economic forces and the way they dictate treatment these days and the 15-minute med checks and so forth,
right.
Spirituality is one of the things which is most likely to drop out under these pressures.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate. And institutionalized religions are not, by and large, offering people increasingly what people want. And there has become actually a phrase that applies to this. It's become quite common, which is that people will say, I'm spiritual but not religious.
Mm-hmm.
And research has shown that about 60% of the population is churched and goes to church or synagogue on a fairly regular basis. About 20% are so-called rational humanists or rational atheists, but a full 20% will use the phrase spiritual but not religious. So it's an important segment of the population, and it's growing. And, you know, mental health professionals really need to be brought up to date on the nature and types of spiritual but non-religious practices and engagement. Most people that practice meditation will call themselves spiritual but not religious. So it's an important distinction, and one that certainly has an impact in the mental health area.
Indeed, yes. And let's hope these distinctions get made increasingly.
Yeah, indeed. The final and eighth therapeutic lifestyle change is contribution and service. From ancient times, service and contribution to others have been regarded as virtues that can benefit both giver and receiver. The world's major spiritual traditions emphasize that, when viewed correctly, service is not necessarily a sacrifice, but rather can foster qualities that serve the giver, such as happiness, mental health, and spiritual maturity. Altruism is said to reduce unhealthy mental qualities such as greed, jealousy, and egocentricity, while enhancing healthy qualities such as love, joy, and generosity. The benefits of service are also said to extend to healing, such that healing oneself and others can be intimately linked. Selfless service, as generally known, is hard to find a factor that's more widespread in the world's religions than that one, isn't it?
It really is, and if you look at all the practices that the great traditions offer, they really, in one way, you can think of them as all culminating in selfless service, that we don't practice for ourselves alone, and if you do practice for yourself alone, it's in some ways increasing the sense of separation and egocentricity, but
right.
To practice with the goal of being of one's own awakening, but also to be a more effective instrument of service in all across all dimensions, from relieving hunger to fostering the awakening of the world. That really is the supreme motive which underlies at least the post-conventional, trans-conventional levels
right.
of all the religions.
Right, exactly. And I think we both suspect that it's that component of religions, the trans-rational, post-conventional change in consciousness away from egocentricity towards selfless service, that as a psychotechnology is something that's going to increase in the coming years, whereas perhaps merely the religious narrative component, you know, may or may not increase, but certainly is not as significant as this post-conventional aim of the great religions. And that aim is one that even in postmodern times we can see the benefit of and appreciate.
Indeed, yeah. And, you know, which way it goes, in some ways there's a battle, at least a battle between these levels,
yeah.
at least from the pre-conventional, pre-rational level sees it as a battle, because of course the trans-rational is seen as heresy.
Exactly, which is, you know, one of the things that makes this such a delicate topic of discussion.
Yeah.
But there, indeed, most of the religions have both pre-rational and trans-rational, and they don't get along well. In our own time, both theory and research point to correlations between altruism and measures of psychological and physical health. Multiple studies, including those that control for prior health factors, suggest that people who volunteer more are psychologically happier and healthier and physically healthier and may even live longer. The so-called paradox of happiness is that spending one's time and resources on others can make one happier. Altruists of all ages may experience a helper's high. Even required community service for adolescence seems to affect long-term positive psychological change, and even mandated monetary donations can make college students happier than spending the money on themselves. I'm sure that's news to the kids, but it's true.
Yeah, it's probably news to all of us. I mean, it's so counterintuitive, but there you have the data.
It is.
It's one of those practices, you know, generosity. We tend to forget that all these things are skills, and that generosity is a capacity that is a self-rewarding one. It's like you start it and you begin to get an appreciation of this actually feels good.
Yeah, and when I first saw this result, when I first learned about it in the Alexander's study of spirituality and religion on college campuses,
uh-huh.
Which incidentally found an astonishing 75% of college students rated spirituality as important or very important to their lives.
That's amazing.
It is, especially since you can't get a discussion, you know, going with any of their professors about it. Again, because of the problems with pre- and trans-rational religions. Anyway, this section concludes, rightfully, I think, contributions and service to others have long been considered central elements of a life well lived. Now they can also be considered central elements of a healthy life. Good for the brain, good for the body, and certainly good for the soul.
Amen. Yep.
Amen. Then there's the whole issue you conclude with, which is definitely worth looking at, and which is so puzzling in certain ways. But it's what you call difficulties of implementing therapeutic lifestyle changes. You say, given the many advantages of therapeutic lifestyle changes, why have mental health professionals been so slow to adopt them? The reasons involve patients, therapists, and society. Effective public health programs will therefore need to address all of them. So start with the patients. TLCs can require considerable and sustained effort, and many patients feel unable or unwilling to tackle them. Patients often have little social support, little understanding of causal lifestyle factors, and a passive expectation that healing comes from an outside authority or a pill. Societally, whole industries are geared towards encouraging unhealthy choices. Patients contend with a daily barrage of psychologically sophisticated advertisements encouraging them, for example, to consume alcohol, nicotine, and fast foods in the never-ending search for what the food industry calls the bliss point of entertainment through hyper-eating. We're up against a lot.
We are. I mean, I forget the exact figures on the amount of advertising money that's thrown at us each year, but it's in the many billions.
Yeah, and it is. It's a fascinating industry in itself, and of course, you know, it gears off of certain actual, you know, positive tastes. Yeah, if positive is the right word, that human beings have. You know, there was a time when it was hard to get fat in our diet, and so we developed a, you know, an abnormal fondness for fatty foods, and now when we can afford it and fat is readily available, we just eat as much of it as we can get down.
Right.
And the, you know, the health effects of these kinds of things are just horrid.
Right. Yeah. No, and again, as you said earlier on, this is really a four-quadrant affair. We're really, really dealing with forces at all in all four quadrants and across multiple levels, actually, too, that given our current culture and socioeconomic systems, et cetera, are pulling us towards unhealthy choices.
Yeah, it's true. And there is always a buck to be made by, you know, selling people what they don't need.
Right.
And so, you know, we're up against all of that. Therapists also face challenges. The first is simply to become familiar with the large literature on TLCs. And this, of course, is something you faced as you were doing this article. It's overwhelming. The second is a professional bias towards pharmacological and formal psychotherapeutic interventions. In addition, fostering patients' TLCs can be time-intensive, can demand considerable therapeutic skill, and is not well reimbursed. Finally, cognitive dissonance may be at work when therapists' own lifestyles are unhealthy. And I suspect that gets to the heart of a lot of the issue right there, is that therapists themselves aren't doing these things, and so they feel a little odd recommending them as a healthy choice to others.
Yes, indeed. Doubtless plays a role.
But the therapists are facing a lot of problems as well, and starting with the fact that they're just not taught this. And a lot of this, the reason they're not taught it, is a lot of it is relatively new research that thought just a decade or two ago just wasn't possible.
Yes, indeed. And there, and just to come back once again to the economic factors, you know, one of the leading people in the whole lifestyle change work was, who's the guy who did the original cardiovascular research? Help me out here, Ken.
Benson?
No, I'm thinking of a guy in California who who actually I know well, but anyway, so much for my memory, and I need more fish oil and exercise and
try exercise, yeah.
But anyway, he made the point that he was a cardiologist. He made the point that he could make about $5,000 for doing a cardiac bypass, but got paid nothing for giving instructions to patients on how they could live in a way which would avoid them.
Yeah, exactly. And he's hit on, you know, exactly what you and I often think of is that lower right quadrant, and that economic pressure, which is just overwhelming enough to see why Marxist arguments got started and are still favorable in some sociological circles. Marx didn't have all of the answers, but he was certainly onto some of them. The material conditions of human beings and economic pressures are overwhelming. They affect our lowest and most basic and primitive and strongest needs, our physiological needs, food, safety, and so on. And without them, we'd literally die. So they're really extraordinarily compelling. And when you can hook those needs up to other things that you don't need, pretty girl with a car, for example, then you've got it made. There's some real issues that we're just up against in general with this topic.
Yes, very much so.
Taken together, these therapist beliefs and biases may constitute a variant of what is called professional deformation. This is a harmful distortion of psychological processes such as cognition and perception that is produced by professional practice and pressures. As long ago as 1915, a sociologist observed that, quote, the continued performance of a certain profession or trade creates in the individual a deformation of the reasoning process. Such deformation is largely a matter of adaptation to environment. The mental health system's current pharmacological emphasis, at the cost of psychotherapeutic, social, and TLC interventions, may be one example. This pharmacological bias is heavily promoted by the pharmaceutical industry, and Marcia Angell, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, concluded that, quote, one result of the intensive bias is that even when changes in lifestyle would be more effective, doctors and their patients often believe that for every ailment and discontent, there is a drug. That is widespread, and the pharmaceutical companies are advertising in mainstream magazines now like crazy and on television. And one of the biggest complaints doctors have is patients come in, requesting this newest medication for this disease that they obviously have, that they read about in Time magazine.
Right. Yes. Yes. So the pressure is coming from multiple directions.
Yeah, that's a flat-out deformation of adequate information transfer and exchange. The advertisements don't tell you what other medications are available or what research has shown are the most effective medications. All they will tell you about are the possible side effects of this medication, and they do that only because their lawyers force them to.
Right.
But it's insane.
Yeah, it's a really tragic system, and I think, you know, we're paying a cost at many, many levels. And one thing we haven't talked about is if, in fact, many of the psychopathologies we're facing in the present day in modernity are a reflection or expression or complication of modern lifestyles, then not to treat them with lifestyle modification is kind of like putting a Band-Aid on or giving someone an aspirin when they have an infectious fever.
Yeah.
Not dealing with the fundamental issue or problem.
Exactly.
And so there's a double whammy here if we simply treat a person, say, who's depressed, living, watching television 6 hours a day, eating junk food, not seeing people, spending a lot of time, just in front of the TV, and we treat them with an antidepressant, we are, in some ways, we're just not doing this person a service at all.
Yeah, some of these things, especially after we've heard the data in this article, some of these treatment choices really border on criminal negligence. It's just bad medicine, and it's poorly informed and is really ignoring some choices for which there's, you know, a really significant amount of evidence. And some of these choices should be done in any event, you know, whether you specifically have a particular pathology or not, just because they are, you know, so good for most of the systems in the human body.
Yeah, yeah.
You conclude with this. Wide-scale adoption of therapeutic lifestyle changes will likely require wide-scale interventions that encompass educational, mental health, and public health systems. Political interventions may also be necessary, for example, to reduce children's exposure to media's violence and unhealthy food advertising. Of course, these are major requirements. However, given the enormous mental, physical, social, and economic costs of contemporary lifestyles, such interventions may be essential. In the 21st century, therapeutic lifestyles may need to be a central focus of mental, medical, and public health. And God bless you for doing this article. I think if we're going to see some of these changes, this will historically be looked at as one of the first steps. I know people that read it are going to be as surprised as I was by some of these findings. And I personally am glad, because I know all the trouble you had to go through to do all this research. And like you say, if you'd known, you'd have thought a little bit harder about it.
Really?
But thankfully, you didn't, and you stepped into
right.
this. And once in it, you know, because you're a responsible, competent person, you did a really good job. And I just wanted to personally thank you on behalf of all of the patients out there and human beings in general for some very wise advice.
Well, thanks very much, Ken. And as part of the big picture, you know, as we've talked about a couple of times, we're just beginning in some ways to see the impact of the dramatic acceleration of technology and its effects on lifestyle. So these issues are just going to increase in importance.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's in the categories and in that delicate dialectic of modernity, many great things and several bad things. This is definitely in the column already. Some of them are just flat out bad, and many of them are bare close watching.
Yeah,
it is a grand experiment that we're underway here, and we just don't know where it's going.
Indeed. Well said. That's exactly where we are.
Okay, buddy. Listen, thank you so much for taking this much time and going over this. I really appreciate it. I know people listening to this are going to appreciate it. And I'll be seeing you soon, buddy.
Well, thanks so much for getting the word out. Very much appreciated. Thanks, Ken.
Absolutely, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.